Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Steve Brown, sitting in for Ann today. If you tuned into the President's State of the Union address on Tuesday, you likely heard a pretty confident commander-in-chief. President Obama outlined the items on his agenda: job growth, universal pre-K, tax, and immigration reform. Some items require congressional approval, but the president had this to say about waiting for Congress.
But America does not stand still, and neither will I. So wherever and whenever I can take steps without legislation to expand opportunity for more American families, that's what I'm going to do.
Today, we're discussing the State of the Union speech. Joining me now in studio to talk about the president's promise to proceed with or without Congress is Paul Beck, Distinguished Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Ohio State. Paul, welcome.
Good to be with you, Steve.
Also on the phone, Jack Torrey, Columbus Dispatch, Washington Bureau Chief. Welcome to the show, Jack.
Great to be here.
Listeners, we want to hear from you as well. Call the show, 614-292-8513. Again, 292-8513. You can also send an email to allsides@wosu.org. You can tweet the show at WOSU All Sides and send us a note on Facebook. Paul Beck, I didn't mention this in our pre-show chat, but I would be remiss if I did not ask you about Michael Drake being named the new president of Ohio State University today.
Well, exciting news. He seems like a really top-notch candidate. Irvine, where he was chancellor, the top person on that campus, is a major university, a research university, very much like Ohio State. He seems to have had a really great career in the California system, beginning there as an assistant professor and moving on up the ranks to a top administrative post. And so it's a very exciting prospect. It's always nice to see a new president come in. It's often not so nice to see an old one go who's been good. But I'm really looking forward to Michael Drake coming in June.
Anything in particular about Mr. Drake's resume or his accomplishments that you're looking forward to?
Well, I think two things are particularly important, and I say this as a faculty member. One is that he has been a faculty member in the ranks in a top university system, in the UC system, which may be the best public university system in the world. And so he understands what faculty do, and he has moved up in the ranks. And then he's been the top administrator of a major campus, a major public university with a profile very much like Ohio State's, not as big as Ohio State or perhaps as complex as Ohio State, but a very good place. And so those are two things that faculty look for. They want somebody who understands our enterprise, and faculty in many ways are at the heart of a university, but they also want somebody who has the administrative credentials and experience to be able to handle all of the challenges of this huge campus.
Michael Drake would also become the first African-American president in the history of Ohio State University. Have you ever met Michael Drake?
I never have. I have friends at Irvine, so I will be checking with them. But what I hear, or at least what I read, sounds very positive about him.
And again, WOSU TV and 89.7 NPR News will have coverage of the Board of Trustees' appointment of Michael Drake to be the next president of Ohio State University. That will be this afternoon during All Things Considered. And again, you can also see WOSU TV coverage on the Ohio Channel and also at WOSU.org. Now back to our original topic, the State of the Union. Jack Torrey from the Columbus Dispatch, what was the main takeaway for you from the address? Was it the executive orders? Was it the president's talking about congressional gridlock, or was it something else?
I was actually impressed with how modest the speech was. I mean, to be a wise guy, I'm not quite sure why he even bothered to give it, because it really didn't break any terrible new ground. His talk about executive orders, even that was sort of modest. I mean, we're talking about minimum wage for new federal contractors. That doesn't exactly have the sweep of Abraham Lincoln signing an order to free the slaves, or Richard Nixon signing an executive order to create the Environmental Protection Agency. And so he got the worst of both worlds. He talked a tough game there on that, but he didn't exactly then take a bold move. But that's been very characteristic of this president. He is not what I would call a bold leader. I think he would have been better off had he just decided that, look, the reality is I've got a Republican House, a Democratic Senate. I got to figure out a way to get something through both of these chambers. And there were topics such as tax reform, which he touched on, immigration reform, which he touched on, that I think that they have an opportunity to get something done on. But he didn't take that opportunity.
Paul Beck, your thoughts? Did you have the same takeaway? No new ground, as Jack Torrey says?
I had much of the same takeaway. It's hard to plow new ground when you've got a House that is dominated by the opposing party that has been very oppositional to everything that President Obama has proposed, and a Senate that still has a filibuster when it comes to policy matters, where Republican minorities can actually block action there. So I think that he was modest, but modesty is appropriate. The one thing that I was struck by was how, at the beginning now of his sixth year in office, how conciliatory he was towards the opposition. He challenges the Republicans to do things, but he challenges them in a very modest way. Mm-hmm. He wasn't very specific on immigration reform. I think he's really waiting to see what's going to happen from both this retreat, where they may come up with some kind of a unified policy stance, or later legislation down the road. I don't think he wants to get in the way of that. He sounds like he is willing to make a deal with them. We will see, of course, whether they're willing to make a deal and whether it's a deal that he will accept. I would add to that I think this is very characteristic of President Obama. I've been following him for a long time, from the days that he was in the legislature in Illinois. And he's always somebody, and this doesn't really get emphasized much, who's been quite willing to reach across the aisle to the other party. If you remember his 2004 speech at the Democratic Convention, it was one of these kind of, you know, anti-partisan polarization speeches. And I think that's been characteristic of him over time. I think he's paid a price for that, both among his Democratic colleagues who feel he's not tough enough in attacking the opposition, and maybe his Republican opponents who have tried to take advantage of that.
Getting to your point that you saw the president's speech as almost conciliatory, Carl Hughes wrote in the New York Times on Wednesday that the president's call to action was really more of a concession to reality, that he can't push an agenda through a gridlock Congress. Jack Torrey, the president, and a lot of other Democrats would say they've tried with Congress, and they're at their wits' end. They can't go any further trying to come to bipartisan legislation, to a bipartisan agreement.
Well, this, you know, you're talking about the President of the United States, the most powerful office in the world. Bill Clinton faced this exact same dilemma in 1995. His party had a horrible rebuke at the polls, and he lost the House, he lost the Senate, and there was question of whether he was even relevant anymore. But Clinton was very nimble politically, and he was able to focus on issues that he could get through the Republican Congress. It included welfare reform. It included the 1997 balanced budget agreement, which helped usher in 4 years of surpluses. And yet he knew how to be firm at the same time. When the Republicans wanted to shut down the government over the budget in 95, he stood firm on that. So he showed a lot more flexibility than President Obama has shown. For example, one of the things that struck me immediately was he's making a call for the type of enhanced authority to negotiate trade agreements that virtually every other president has had. But he does it in a half-hearted way, and then yesterday Harry Reid announces, well, we're not going to take this up in the Senate this year. I have to tell you, if a majority leader had done that to Lyndon Johnson in 1965, the next day that guy would have been found floating face down the Potomac River. I mean, you have to be tough with both members of both parties, and there are issues in which you can reach an agreement with Republicans on if you're willing to break from your party base. Paul's a lot more knowledgeable on this than I am, but I do disagree. I don't think he's been very effective in reaching across party lines, and I think partly that has to do with his personality. He is the cold, aloof professor. Sorry, Paul. And he is, you know, the smartest guy in the room, and it's hard to establish a great relationship that way.
Paul Beck, also a professor, not as cold or aloof, though, I suppose. Your reaction to what Mr. Torrey says, that President Obama is not reaching across the aisle as much as maybe you might see or some others might see?
Well, there's a different style, obviously, and each president has his own style features to it. There's nobody like Bill Clinton in terms of his political sense, maybe would be the way to put it. There's nobody like Lyndon Johnson in terms of his sense of how to wield power. We need to remember, though, that Johnson was coming off the Kennedy assassination, and in 1964 or 65, when his second term began, had an overwhelmingly Democratic Congress. So he was negotiating with Democrats there. In the case of Obama, I think we need to look to see what the issues are going to be on which he will try to seek some kind of bipartisan agreement. The best bet right now, I think, is probably immigration reform. He may not get the full package that the Senate has passed, but he may get pieces of that package. It'll be very interesting to see how he works with the Republicans and reacts to the Republicans if they are able to come together with some kind of a package of their own. They may not be able to do that. There's deep division within the Republican House over immigration reform and a variety of other things.
What's the division over immigration reform?
Well, I think there are many Republicans who, whether it's a majority or not, we'll find out, but there are many Republicans who don't want any kind of immigration reform that involves citizenship. There have been statements out of Washington, out of the leadership on the Republican side that says, well, maybe we will, in terms of citizenship, allow a path to citizenship for the children of people who came here illegally, but only grant legal residence to people who entered the country illegally, but no citizenship. Now, that's a different stance than the Senate took. It's not what President Obama wants. Will he settle for that, or will the Republicans agree to do that? There are many Republicans who would not go that far. They don't want to see that.
We're talking about Tuesday's State of the Union address with Jack Torrey, the Washington Bureau Chief for the Columbus Dispatch, and here in studio, Paul Beck, a longtime political scientist at Ohio State University. Listeners, we want to hear from you as well. Call 614-292-8513. Again, the phone number is 614-292-8513. You can also email allsides@wosu.org. Jack Torrey, President Obama has been called kind of a bully by some Republicans that he's you talk about how he's not tough enough. I think the opposite is the criticism from a lot of Republicans. That's obviously a lot, if not mostly, political conjecture. But is it politically feasible for him to be a lot tougher?
Well, first of all, the Republicans are just kidding themselves. This man is not a bully. They have, a memory failure because past presidents have used authority that is not in the Constitution to get their way. A classic example was President Truman in 1950 sent, half a million American forces to South Korea without a declaration of war, without even approval of the Congress. He simply described it as a police action. What my problem with Obama is that he may talk a tough line, but he hasn't been able to match it with a bold action. Let me give you an example. Income inequality. There are a number of people who will argue that the best way to combat income inequality is through education and job training. And his preschool plan from last year was exactly the right thing. The problem is he offered a financing mechanism that he knew had no chance of passing the House, and that was to raise the tobacco tax. So instead of trying to find a realistic way to pay for it, and it's about $75 billion over 10 years, he just sort of threw that out and then ran away from it. He has this opportunity still if he wants to take that on, but it might require him to take on the left wing of his party on entitlement reform, which would then produce the kind of money they need to channel into younger people. Because under his watch, as under previous presidents, the federal government is devoting more and more resources to people my age and less resources to younger people, the future of this country. And we have too many people who, by age of 6 and 7, without the proper preschool training, they're sort of lost in this system. And the way to make certain that you can close the income inequality gap is through education and then job training at a later age. I'd be curious if Paul agrees or disagrees on that.
We're going to spend a lot of time in the next segment talking about income inequality. But Paul Beck, your thoughts?
Oh, I agree with Jack completely. I think there is division on the Democratic side also. And even though President Obama from time to time has talked about entitlement reform, and the grand bargain that was discussed a couple of years ago would have involved some entitlement reform. He's not really pushed very hard on that, and he would get blowback from his Democratic colleagues in the Senate and the House on it. I say this as somebody on Medicare and Social Security, but I think Jack is exactly right that we have decided in this country to devote major resources to the elderly, which has been a good thing in many, many ways. But in a very tight budget, it means we are not devoting enough resources to the future and to young people, both in terms of education. You know, pre-kindergarten is one example of that, but there are a whole host of other examples. And that's, I think, an issue that we are going to have to grapple with as a country. What is the right balance to strike between making sure that we protect our children and grandchildren into the future, while we still are preserving the situation for elderly Americans?
We're talking about the president's fifth State of the Union address on Tuesday. Jack Tory from the Columbus Dispatch has to leave us now. Jack, thanks so much for your time this morning.
I was glad to be here, and I enjoyed it. As always, I enjoy talking to Paul. I think he's one of the ablest and smartest political scientists in the United States. And by the way, I like the new president. He's got a tough act to follow. He may want to check the weather report before leaving California, though, and going to Columbus.
Good point, good point. Paul Beck from Ohio State University, stand by. After the break, we'll bring in another voice as we talk more about the president's focus on upward mobility and income inequality. That's just ahead here on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're also streaming at WOSU.org/allsides. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Steve Brown sitting in for Ann today. The president's State of the Union address on Tuesday night contained some major themes: his promise to expand opportunity for Americans with or without congressional help and fixing whatever's blocking opportunity. In his speech, the president acknowledged that stock prices and skyrocketing corporate profits mean life is better than ever at the top, but not necessarily for everyone else.
Inequality has deepened. Upward mobility has stalled. The cold hard fact is that even in the midst of recovery, too many Americans are working more than ever just to get by, let alone to get ahead.
Still with me in studio is Paul Beck, distinguished professor emeritus of political science at Ohio State University, joining us now here in studio as well to talk about the president's plan to restore upward mobility is Randy Olson. He's the director of the Center for Human Resource Research at Ohio State. Welcome to you, Mr. Olson.
Thank you very much.
And you've studied labor markets for more than 20 years. How has upward mobility changed?
Well, I think it's quite right that mobility probably has slowed. But I don't think it's changed remarkably in the most recent years at all. There've been some minor changes, but nothing that really sticks out. I think all the damage to inequality and upward mobility probably occurred about the time of the globalization of markets, when essentially wages for less skilled positions are being set at the world level. And so, like it or not, the wages at the bottom end of the skill spectrum are being set outside the U.S. There's really not much you can do to prevent that, except if you do you have to do two things. You have to stop immigration into the United States completely, and you have to not trade with the rest of the world in goods that embody less skilled labor.
Neither of those things are happening.
Neither one of those things are happening, and neither one of them should happen. But there is a principle in economics that you can either have mobility in trade or you can have mobility in factors of production, which is to say, if you restrict trade, then you're going to induce more mobility of labor across national boundaries. So you have it one way or another. So let's kind of get over it. That ship has sailed. this the 50s are gone and they're not coming back.
You say that upward mobility has not changed much in recent years. That seems contrary to the national discourse, to what you hear on a day-to-day basis, both from politicians or if you're walking around at the gas station. People seem kind of resigned to the fact that upward mobility has decreased, but you're saying that's not the case.
Well, there's a difference between what we're talking about, kind of upward mobility and general prosperity. Let's not beat around the bush. The problem here is that the economic policies of the administration and the Federal Reserve Board have failed. That where we are today is that the United States has a labor market that, if the labor market conditions in July of 2008 held today, last time I looked, it would be about 10,800,000 more people would have jobs than is currently the case.
What policies in particular are you talking about?
Maybe we should say all of the above, but I think what distinguishes the Great Recession has not been the depth of the recession. What distinguished the Great Recession is really the lack of a vigorous recovery. And unlike every other recession, things have just stalled. I think the administration has certainly, you can't accuse them of having a kind of a pro-business orientation, for heaven's sakes. I think a lot of the policies that were instituted at the transition from the Bush to the Obama administration, one could say that Barack Obama doubled down on some of the worst policies of the Bush administration. I think the TARP program and the bailouts program were ineffective, did not work. The stimulus program that was greatly oversold did not achieve what it was said it would achieve. Even some of the small things that could be done that would make a difference haven't been done. For example, the Keystone Pipeline issue. That's sort of the canary in the coal mine. If the administration can't see its way clear to approve that, then what hope is there for larger and more aggressive initiatives to make the economy better? The way the administration has dealt with banks, they have pretty much got the banks, I don't know, probably terrorized is probably a little strong a word, but if you look at the behavior of banks from 2008 and on, what we've seen is the Federal Reserve churning out huge amounts of liquidity, and the question is, so where did all that liquidity go? Well, the first place it went was overseas into the reserve accounts of European banks. When they had pretty much topped off their reserves, it's flowed into the U.S. banks. And so it's pretty well known that banks are accumulating huge amounts of reserves. They're not lending it out simply because the business climate is so bad. It doesn't make sense to lend if you don't have creditworthy borrowers or people with good business prospects.
This is all very interesting. It's getting a little off topic from our discussion on upward mobility in the State of the Union address. I guess my next question to you would be, are you surprised at all then that the president is trying to put upward mobility at the front of his administration as a key priority in the nation? If you say it hasn't changed much, is it just because it's such a politically advantageous thing for a Democrat to say? Is that...
I would characterize that as there's a squirrel rhetorical device. That the essential problem here, you might think it's off topic, but I think it really is on topic in terms of what's happening to people at the lower reaches of the income distribution. The single biggest problem is their inability to find work. You can take care of a lot of inequality and lack of upward mobility if people have jobs. It's not a very good situation when young people graduate with a college degree, and lo and behold, they find that their best opportunity is waiting table at Applebee's or wherever. Another example of sort of a counterproductive strategy, I think you have to say that the Obamacare, the way that is structured, has clearly caused a decrease in the amount of full-time employment that's in the economy. At last look, there are fewer people with full-time jobs now than in July 2008, which is really quite a testament given all the population growth.
Let's bring Paul back into this conversation. We talked about it a little bit with Jack Tory, but the president putting upward mobility at the front of his State of the Union address, making it a theme throughout the address. Is it, like I asked Mr. Olson, just because it's so politically advantageous for a Democrat to say this?
Well, I think what a president tries to do in a State of the Union address, and this has been true since they've been given over the many years, is talk about the State of the Union at present, but also try to lay out an agenda for the future. The agenda that he laid out on Tuesday night was very much like the agenda that he talked about the year before, not big differences there. But that agenda, of course, has not been realized. And so he's kind of coming back to that. And I think the broad theme that he's trying to tie a lot of things together with is this theme of inequality. And I think Randy, in many ways, hit the nail on the head here in talking about inequality. There really, it seems to me, three things that have happened that have kind of come together at the same time. And that is the poor don't have the kind of social safety net that they had before welfare reform and other changes in the 1990s. We see that in the number of homeless. We see that in food banks that are just strapped these days. And so that particular segment of the population is in deep trouble. The middle class has seen its standard of living kind of stagnate since the mid-70s. For reasons that Randy talked about, there have been major structural changes in the economy. I actually don't think there's much that a president or a Congress or a president and Congress together can do to somehow bring back the old days, you know, to rectify that situation. The forces are so broad and so global that it's very difficult to really, so you can handle them with the margins. And then what we've seen, and here I'd go back to the tax code, we have seen the very rich in the United States being able to put themselves in a position, because they're very effective at lobbying Congress, where they can get all kinds of benefits through the tax code, including paying much lower rates than ordinary people would pay. All of those things together produce inequality. Those are things that probably need to be treated separately. You know, the whole question of what you do with the poor and homeless is maybe a separate question from what you do with the middle class, maybe a separate question from how you handle the tax code and the rich. I think the Affordable Health Care Act, for all of its warts, and there are real problems with it, certainly in terms of implementation, was an attempt to try to bring a number of people who are poor because they don't have health care, because in some cases they have been totally strapped economically because they have serious medical problems, and it has simply destroyed their quality of life and as well as their income. It's an attempt to try to broaden coverage there. It was a very bold thing for the president to do, and I think he's paying for the boldness in a way. But it may be an important thing over the long run if the two parties can work together, which they haven't been able to do up until this point, to say, okay, there's some good things about it. There's some other things about so-called Obamacare that we need to try to tinker with so that we can perfect this program or make it as good as it mm-hmm. can be.
We do have a caller on the line, Hal, calling from Clintonville. Good morning, Hal.
Good morning. I keep wondering why we keep having this discourse about the past 5 years, you know, in the face of a 40-year problem. Cheap wages, cheap labor started 40 years ago with 5.5 under Nixon. And if you look at the history over the last 60, 70 years in this country, ever since the World War II veterans and the Korean War veterans got to the point where they were past resistance. In other words, they would no longer politically resist what would happen by the movers and shakers in this country, because they were at a point where they had passed being a threat, because they were the greatest military force in the entire world. And after World War II, you did not dare tell them no. And as soon as they got old enough, what we saw was a contraction in the economy and all kinds of shenanigans on Wall Street, all kinds of other things. But at the root of all of this is cheap labor, which becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy because nobody has any money. It's like the Great Depression. Bread was 1 cent, but nobody had a penny.
Randy Olson, your reaction to House comments?
Oh, I think they're just wrong. The economy has prospered mightily from the 50s on. Cheap labor has really not, I don't think, hurt the United States. I believe, to the contrary, I think what has happened is that the United States has helped less advantaged workers around the world. If you've ever been to a third world country and seen the impact of globalization on the lives of those people, you'd be ashamed to say those things. I've seen workers in the Philippines who have college degrees who are essentially able to support their parents and their brothers and sisters and get them through school and keep them in school because they have jobs doing the dreaded outsourcing for the American economy. So there are people in this world who live outside the United States, and we want to keep them in mind.
But speaking in terms of the United States, globalization has lowered upward mobility.
I think what it has done is it has hurt people who relied on unskilled labor. It has hurt people in unionized industries that depended, where their wage premium depended on the lack of competition from outside the United States. The position of the United Auto Workers was essentially enforced by restrictive trade practices in the United States. Once the automobile industry became more global, that wage premium was simply not sustainable, and the predictable happened to the United Auto Workers. Has that hurt mobility? Well, it certainly hurt some people, but there's also the matter of that we've seen a tide that has in fact lifted very nearly all boats. That you just simply can't. It's not quite correct to say, oh, I'm going to pray for my neighbor's cow to die, that someone else has done better off, and ignore the fact that everyone else is also better off. And at the end of the day, that's where we should keep our attention, is having an economy that does the most for everyone, and ignore the issue or pay a little bit less attention to the issue of inequality. It's always going to be there. The very definition of poverty is such that you cannot eliminate it.
It's the nature of the beast for capitalism?
No, absolutely. No, that's nonsense. What poverty in the United States is defined as being below a certain percentile. And, there's always going to be someone below that percentile. You just name the percentile. The poor in the United States today are substantially better off than probably the working class was 50 years ago. That just doesn't compute. There has been tremendous secular progress.
We're talking about the State of the Union address this week and upward mobility. Let's take a quick break, and then we'll continue the discussion with Randy Olson, the director of the Center for Human Resource Research at Ohio State University, as well as Paul Beck, a longtime political scientist at Ohio State University. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher here on 89.7 NPR News. We're also streaming at WOSU.org/allsides. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Steve Brown sitting in for Ann today. We're talking about the President's State of the Union Address and his focus on upward mobility. Here in studio with me today, political scientist Paul Beck, also Randy Olson from Ohio State University's Center for Human Resource Research. Join the discussion, listeners. Give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email allsides at WOSU.org. You can tweet the show at WOSU All Sides, and you can send us a note on Facebook. Paul Beck, we were just talking about globalization and its effect on U.S. upward mobility, and you said you had some thoughts?
Yeah, let me just add a couple of thoughts to what Randy has already said. One is, in face of these powerful structural changes in the American economy, the world economy for that matter, the question becomes, okay, what can government do to try to both position the American workforce so that it can take full advantage of changes and not be hurt by those changes? And I think we have right now a discussion between Republicans and Democrats in Washington about various things that, can be done. There's not a lot of agreement there, but the important thing I think to realize is that these governmental policies can really only affect things at the margins.
What can government do? That's a great macro question for this whole argument.
Well, one is, how do you position American workers to be able to take advantage of a high-tech globalized world? What is our comparative advantage in this area? One that I happen to feel very strongly about is that our comparative advantage has in the past been in our major research universities that students all around the world want to come to. And it's been kind of interesting to me to see the damage that's been done to research universities by governmental policies over time.
By funding? Lack of funding?
Lack of funding at the state level. The cutbacks have been just enormous at the state level. President Gee at Ohio State used to say that he came here years ago when Ohio State was a state-related university, and he left here when Ohio State was a state-located university. That was some exaggeration, obviously.
It sounds like something Gordon Gee would say.
Indeed it was. But I think the important point here is that there has been a withdrawal of government support, particularly state government support, for public universities, lack of investment there, with the costs then fobbed off onto students. And we're seeing this, students and their parents. We're seeing this in the increase in student loans and the like. And even the student loan program is very questionable in many respects. Maybe universities have been encouraged to kind of pass on the costs because increasing costs because of the student loan ability. And that's something that we may want to think about as well. What we've seen, I think, at most universities is an enormous growth in the administrative infrastructure of a university, and much less growth in terms of regular faculty and instructional facilities as well. And so that, again, is something, I mean, this is my world, obviously, that I'm talking about, but that's one area where I think we need to think very hard about, okay, how do we position American students, in this case, to be able to compete effectively in a world that's very much changed from the world that their parents were in.
Yeah, education at the very root of upward mobility, one would think. Randy Olson, your thoughts? Do you agree with Mr. Beck on
Absolutely. I think Paul is exactly right that what the government can do, it's only things around the edges. These larger economic forces are you just can't resist them successfully. One thing that I think we can do and should do a little bit, speaking kind of closer to home in terms of education, is that I think that we need to look in a little bit more careful detail about how the educational process is working out for students at secondary school level and higher education. Let me give you a little example. Currently, it's impossible under state law for the Ohio Department of Education to systematically go back and track the earnings of high school graduates and relate that to their experiences preschool through 12th grade.
Say that again, to track their income with their grade school achievements and progress.
That's exactly right. You can do that with students in go to state-supported colleges and universities. But by law, the Ohio Department of Education can't maintain certain identifiers that would be necessary to do that. Now, one of the first things we want to make sure we understand is which schools are performing well, not just in terms of test scores. I mean, we've heard a whole lot about test scores, perhaps too much about test scores. But one thing I think we really do want to make sure we understand is what are the features of various curricula in the state and how successful they are in training students who, when they leave high school, are able to establish viable careers. And even at the college and university level, there is rather little done to inform students about the earnings implications of the majors that they pursue. So we can talk about the returns to education, but kind of the dirty little secret is there's a huge amount of variation across fields of study and subsequent earnings. I'm not convinced that all students know about this.
Really? I went into journalism knowing it wasn't the best paying profession.
Well, good. And you're, this is what we call revealed preference. You get what you deserve. Certainly got what you asked for. But I think students often do have a basic idea. We completed some work for the Ohio Department of Education looking at teacher supply and demand. And over time, the problems with students getting credentials to teach K through 12 and finding jobs has become better and better known. And students are starting to move away from that particular area of study, but still the number of students who are coming out is substantially larger than what the demand is. But there's, in some states have websites where you can go in and you can look school by school, major by major, and you can see, this is what students earned 1 year after they graduate. This is what they earned 5 years after they graduate. Mm-hmm. Now, there are limitations, and you have to look at students who stay in the state. But this is the sort of information resource that we really need in this state so that students can make informed decisions. And if you decide to major in journalism because you know it pays badly, great. You know, that nobody should say, you know, I'm not going to say you made a mistake.
Right.
You did what was best for you. But you don't want students to say, I'm going to major in biology because it's a STEM field and I should be okay because everybody says STEM professions are all right. Well, here's the bad news. That strategy isn't going to work in the case of biology.
I do want to move the discussion along a little bit. We spent quite a time talking about Ohio, or you did at least, Mr. Olson, about particular state laws. Are there any other reasons why Ohio ranks behind so many other states in upward mobility and in moving and, you know— there are recent studies that show people born in the bottom fifth of all income earners, something like 8% of them make it to the top fifth. But Ohio is underperforming in comparison to other states.
Well, here we are in Columbus, and what's been going on in Columbus that might explain that particular problem? Paul talked a lot, and rightly so, about the role of education. What has been going on in Columbus City schools has been an absolute travesty. And to think for just don't even think for a moment that hasn't had an impact on outcomes for students in Columbus. But it's no secret that a lot of public school systems are underperforming. One of the things we don't really understand as well as we should is the extent to which this underperformance is due to the functioning of the education system versus the economic disadvantage of the parents. That's something that we really need to look at a lot more carefully. But education is very key. And then also the business environment. There are certain states that are doing very, very well, and the legal framework in those states can be substantially different from what it is in Ohio, and companies will gravitate toward those states, you know, whether you like it or not.
We're talking about upward mobility in light of the president's State of the Union address on Tuesday. Paul Beck, for a longtime political scientist at Ohio State University, any other political reasons that you know of why Ohio might lag behind other states in terms of upward mobility? It's an especially large problem in southern states, nearly all southern states, but Ohio appears somewhat unique in the Midwest and kind of Rust Belt area even.
Well, although I think Ohio has suffered more than most states from the structural changes in the economy. We were a heavy manufacturing state during the really growth years where Ohio particularly prospered. As the manufacturing side of the economy has gone down, as foreign competition has eroded that, Ohio has suffered a lot for it. The other thing I would note, aside from North Dakota, which is having an oil boom and is the best place to go if you want a job these days, the states that have really experienced and have been advantaged have been the Sun Belt states. There is a movement out of Ohio. We're very sensitive to that right now, having come through this cold weather, how much better it would be to be in Arizona or Florida or, you know, one of these other Sun Belt states. So there's been that kind of growth there. Ohio has also an older population, mainly because younger people have been moving away. Once they're educated here, they go somewhere else to seek their livelihood, and it's because the jobs have not been plentiful here in Ohio. So there's a mix of things there. Whether we're going to be able, through governmental policy, to move our way out of that, we'll just have to wait and see. The governor obviously has put that as his top priority, to increase the number of good jobs in Ohio. I think it's too early to know how all that is going to come out, because every state is doing that. I mean, we're not alone in following these policies. We're kind of competing with one another to lure industries, and I think that in the long run, that's probably not a very good kind of policy to follow. It's, you know, one of these things where I don't think we exactly know what the levers are that we can use to try to attract or keep, maybe keep is a better term, keep young people in Ohio and have them contribute to a more buoyant economy.
Randy Olson, just about 2 minutes left. So I suppose we should close with what you expect and what do you think in terms of upward mobility, in terms of the trajectory for the U.S. over the next 5, 10, 20 years? Do you expect things to change?
I wish I knew. I don't know. Nothing is preordained. I don't know, and I don't think anybody knows.
Globalization will presumably increase in the next few years.
It's at a pretty high level right now. If we see the Chinese economy slowing down, and that gets transmitted to some of the less developed countries. It's the last 2 weeks in the foreign capital markets have not been happy weeks. If that's a sign of things to come, that could be a real problem. If other countries slide into recession, we won't be hit as nearly as hard, but it'll hurt.
Well, this has been a really fascinating discussion. We've been talking about upward mobility in light of the President Obama making it such a large issue in his State of the Union address on Tuesday. I've been joined all hour long by Paul Beck, a distinguished professor emeritus of political science at Ohio State University. Paul, pleasure to have you.
Good to be here, Steve.
And
thank
as well
you.
As Randy Olson, the director of the Center for Human Resource Research at Ohio State University. Fascinating stuff, Randy. Thanks to you as well. Okay, and you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher here on 89.7 NPR News. We're also streaming at WOSU.org/allsides.